Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. Fear is our most dreaded emotion, but without it, we can't learn. Fear is often used as a tool to control people. Since it's so dreaded, we'll do anything to avoid feeling it. The key to releasing ourselves from its grip is to invite it in, feel it, and ask ourselves what fear is trying to teach us. Exploring fear instead of reacting out of it is one of the ways we can free ourselves from being controlled by it. Fear is so universal an emotion, its absence may be a sign of pathology. So the next time you envy someone who appears to be fearless, remember, they probably aren't. And if they are, they're in trouble. This hour, I'll be interviewing psychologist Harriet Lerner about her recent book, The Dance of Fear. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Reading a newspaper can be an aggravating experience. Last week, the Associated Press carried a news item with the title, Fat Type Linked to Heart Disease. I thought, uh-oh. The implication of the research, the AP article said, was that people might someday be tested for this fat just as they are for cholesterol now. I thought, here we go again. So I looked at the actual research article. It wasn't about a type of fat. It was about oxidized LDL, low-density lipoprotein. Oxidized LDL comes from inflammation, free radicals, and other forms of oxidative stress, as well as from a cascade of immune responses to damaged blood vessel walls. Wouldn't a better headline have been inflammation linked to heart disease? Yes, but the research article didn't spell that out. The only implication the journalist could make was to the conventional wisdom on cholesterol. The AP article itself was not a big deal. What was aggravating was what did and didn't get into the newspaper and the research article. Journalists draw implications from the research so it will mean something to readers and make their editors happy. Researchers draw implications from their results so it will mean something to their professional peers, funding sources, and promotion committees. In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and for quite some time after, the conventional media simply repeated the press releases from the State Department and Pentagon. Journalists now flagellate themselves for being so naive and for abandoning their independence. Yet, as we are reminded almost daily by independent journalists like Amy Goodman, insider journalism still prevails, only wrapped in a cloak of arm's-length independence characterized as responsible journalism. Science reporting in the conventional media is not far removed from this kind of insider journalism. The research that is reported is pretty much restricted to what's published by the conventional science journals and government agencies. The what's in it for me implications of the research that are reported to us are taken from the researchers' conclusions. Other voices included in the news are typically drawn from the acknowledged experts. As to researchers, the late John Lee was frequently aggravated by conclusions that weren't supported by the actual research results. And even when the results do support the conclusions, the researchers often miss important implications, as in the case of oxidized LDL. The role of oxidized LDL in artery disease has been discussed for over 10 years. What was new about this research was that oxidized LDL actually seems to start the whole process of artery damage. What causes LDL to oxidize? Inflammation, free radicals, oxidative stress. You can do something about that, not just wait for a new test and a bunch of drugs to go along with it. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Fawcett. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, a writer, and a health strategies advisor who works with me on this program and the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. In addition to his work on the newsletter, he works with people making health decisions. You can reach him by going to our website or calling 707-874-1496, and our website is yourownhealthandfitness.com. Now back to the topic at hand, which is fear, and let me introduce our guest, Harriet Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, Ph.D., who is the author of the book we're discussing today, The Dance of Fear, Harriet Lerner, Ph.D., is one of our nation's most loved and respected relationship experts. Renowned for her work on the psychology of women and family relationships, she served as a staff psychologist at the Menninger Clinic for more than two decades. A distinguished lecturer, workshop leader, and psychotherapist, she is the author of The Dance of Anger, and then, of course, today we're discussing The Dance of Fear, and several other best-selling books. She is also, with her sister, an award-winning children's book writer. She and her husband are therapists in Lawrence, Kansas, and have two sons. And we're really honored to have you back on the show, Dr. Lerner.
I'm delighted to be here.
Looking at this book, when I found it and discovered that you'd written it, I just have to think that our particular political climate contributed to your interest in this subject.
Well, it may have heightened my interest in the subject, but I actually didn't need an additional contributor to my interest in the subject of fear. And actually, this book is about the big three, anxiety, fear, and shame, because these emotions have always been with us, and humans have always responded to them in ways that get us in trouble, whether it's in the personal realm, which is where I work. I work in smaller systems of individuals, marriage, families, partners, and it gets us, anxiety and fear gets us in trouble in the same way in larger societal and political systems. But it has always been with us.
Since you're using that term, systems, I think it would be interesting to hear how applying your study of systems perspectives informs how you interpret crisis behavior, which is what we're talking about today.
The way a systems perspective is different from an individual perspective is that if you think of anxiety and fear from an individual psychiatric perspective, you think of the problem as being underneath someone's skin. It's underneath one person's skin. So that person gets a psychiatric diagnosis or medication, which is real enough. However, anxiety is also the property of systems and groups, and it moves around like a hot potato. And we are always passing anxiety along to other people, and we're always responding to the level of anxiety in any system, which, as you were implying earlier, is very high in our societal system now. So if you think of anxiety simply as a psychiatric problem under one person's skin, that would be a very narrow perspective, rather than thinking about, is your workplace an anxious workplace? Is your family an anxious family? Is your community anxious? Is your society anxious? Because larger systems get anxious too. Anxiety is a property of systems as well as individuals.
So we're talking about anxiety here, and I think there's a difference really between fear and anxiety, and it might be good to differentiate here what the difference is between being fearful and having anxiety.
The more we talked about it, I think the differences would disappear, because sometimes it's merely a linguistic distinction. We might talk about having a fear of dying, or someone might say, I have anxiety about dying. You know, I'm anxious to fly. I have a fear of flying. And there are some differences. The amorphous, underground, chronic anxiety we live with, where we're not even clear about the sources, or you wake up 3 a.m. awash in anxiety, you're not sure why. We tend to use the word anxiety in that situation, whereas if it's a specific fear, like in the book I start out with my fear of public speaking, we usually use that when it's a fear of something we can define.
So is there a difference between a fear and a phobia?
Phobia implies a much more intense neurochemical storm that happens. Many people have a fear of flying, and they take a Valium or they have ways to calm themselves when they get on the plane. if you have a genuine phobia, it's not going to help for people to tell you to take a Valium and wash it down with a cocktail and sit there giving yourself a mantra that it's safer to fly than to drive, because a phobia is a much more powerful neurochemical kind of storm. And there are treatments for phobias, and I'm actually, as a therapist, I'm less concerned about phobias than where we started, that as a community and as humans, we operate daily with a lot of anxiety that we may not even be aware of, that mucks up our thinking and mucks up our relationships and puts us on a downward spiraling course when we don't even know anxiety is the culprit. We think of it that we are doing our best thinking when really we are anxiously reacting.
Mm-hmm.
Or we say to ourselves that we are giving other people what they need and deserve. Or we get very stuck in either distance or blame, which is an anxiety-driven position if you're stuck in it. And we don't even know that the culprit is, you know, that we're in the anxious soup mm-hmm. and we're not doing our best thinking.
I have to think, and this is an opinion, that the roots of fear, anxiety, and phobias often are old, that they stem from some learned response. From what I've studied about the stress response in our bodies, what happens is that the brain actually reorients itself physically around this high level of stress hormones that gets created during chronic stress. And so people actually will begin to have their amygdala, which is the repository of scary memories and stuff, get very large, and the hippocampus, which enables you to let go of stuff a little bit, starts to get very small. So there's actual physical changes in the brains of people who are raised in traumatic situations.
And we should also add to that fear is not all bad, that throughout all of evolutionary history, fear has helped our species, and I guess all species, to be wary, to be awake, to look out for danger and trouble for ourselves and those we love, and hopefully for all of humanity. So anxiety and fear are very positive adaptive responses at every level.
Yeah.
For example, maybe you need to get more anxious about money so that you pay attention and attend to business. Or maybe your anxiety is telling you that you should not send that long, angry, detailed letter to your sister or your mother. I mean, anxiety in so many ways is a positive warning signal. But it also, you know, as we've been talking about, is quite a troublemaker in both overt and covert ways.
Well, particularly when it's functioning on a covert level under the surface without people being aware of it. What I'm suggesting is that, yes, I think fear is a learned response, and I'm suggesting that even a phobia, in a way, is somewhere a learned response, although it may have gotten waylaid and gone off on a right turn somewhere. But it brings up the question of whether or not there's different styles of therapy dealing with old feelings, basically, and one is to do a feeling-based therapy where people go back and try to unwind the knot to find out where this particularly obstreperous habituated feeling is coming from that's disrupting their lives, versus doing a cognitive behavioral therapy where you've described in the book snapping having a rubber band on your wrist and snapping it to remind you to sort of pay attention to what you're doing, to come into the present. And I get the feeling from reading your books that you kind of go back and forth between the two styles. You don't concentrate on one style.
Well, I'm neither a cognitive behavioral therapist, or where I started out as a psychoanalytic therapist, where I believe that people had to spend years and years rooting around in their past history in order to make changes. I actually, if anything, if you read The Dance of Fear or The Dance of Anger, in a way I have the opposite theory. I believe that very often it is after you get the courage to change your behavior in a relationship, even if you are quite anxious doing it, it's after you make the change that you can really see that relationship and know yourself more fully. I want to add something to the conversation that you're bringing up about anxiety coming from trauma in our history and what we bring from the past, and that has effects on the brain and our physiology. And, of course, just, you know, genetically we're all different. Some of us have a fear center, to not put it scientifically, that's very easily jolted. We have anxiety from every source. We're all in this anxious soup together. Every person has anxiety that they bring from their first family that goes generations back, you know, what mm-hmm. the previous generations haven't resolved. So there's all the anxiety you bring from your very dysfunctional first family. And I love Mary Carr's definition of a dysfunctional family as any family with more than one person in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so true. So we have that, as you point out, and we have anxiety that comes as we move along the life cycle. The normative life cycle events bring us anxiety. You know, having children, dealing with aging parents, the launching of children, the addition and subtraction of family members. And we all deal with all kinds of anxiety and stresses that we never signed up for, whether it's poverty, job loss, infidelity, addictions, chronic illness. We could each make our own list of things that we did not raise our hand and volunteer for, but the universe plunked in our path. And then you add to that the societal system and the anxiety of the society that we live in and what's generated there. So all of us have a lot of anxiety, and in some ways, you know, maybe we should be wary of the people who go around saying they have no anxiety. They see nothing to be anxious about. It's so interesting that when anxiety disrupts functioning, it's considered a psychiatric illness. We have no diagnosis for indifference, the most dangerous emotion of all, and we have no diagnosis for people who say they're not anxious or fearful, but they're not anxious or fearful because they may be passing that anxiety along or down the hierarchy to others.
Another way to say this is that being a human and having the ability to know that you're going to die and that you're vulnerable creates a whole raft of ways that we attempt to protect ourselves. And as you say, and as I was starting to say too, stress or cortisol and the way that the body adapts around those things is the way that we learn. It's embedded in the way that we learn. So,
yes, and if you take that to the behavioral level, Lena, that there's a really important point here, because fear is not the culprit. It's not the dreadful way that anxiety or fear feels in the body that's the problem, whether it's moderate agitation or a full-blown panic attack. We are all capable of managing the most anguishing physical sensations when we understand what is happening to us, when we know that it feels dreadful, but we will survive. The problem comes from either avoidance, you know, you want to avoid fear and anxiety and shame, so you make your life very narrow and small, or it comes, as you say, from the ways that we protect ourselves, whether it's in the workplace or in intimate relationships or politically, the ways in which we very quickly try to get comfortable. And then we try to get comfortable, we end up operating at the expense of ourselves and other people and the world we live in.
I just want to make a quick point, and then I'd like to ID the show. What I was trying to say is that we are in the process of learning things when we get afraid or stressed out, and that there's a benefit to learning and staying in touch with the appropriate amount of fear that we fear as we go along. But
right.
there's another important point, which is that the consciousness that we have as humans, that we're capable of dying, that we're transient. One of the things that I think people forget in their daily lives is that they think that the death thing is sort of something that happens at the end of your life, and that,
right,
in fact, in the process of being alive, you're constantly losing things and getting new things. So there's constantly letting go and losing things and grieving and moving on, and sort of, you can't really, if you sort of strap yourself in and contract yourself, you actually miss out on the experience of being alive. So that kind of breathing in and out of being afraid and learning and letting go is something that happens constantly up to the point that we die, and it includes our ability to let go graciously. Just quickly want to ID the show. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Harriet Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, Ph.D. She has several books, but the two that we are concentrating on today particularly is The Dance of Fear. She also is the author of The Dance of Anger, and her website is harrietlerner, L-E-R-N-E-R.com. So one of the things that you've been talking about is that people don't always know that they're frightened or upset or anxious, and so they have these coping mechanisms that look on the surface as if they're just taking care of business. And you have these,
right,
classic sort of styles that people have. The two most interesting ones that we see a lot is this sort of over and under functioning stuff.
Right, and it's a therapist. There are people, of course, who will come to see me because they are feeling very anxious. You know, they'll come in and they'll say, I have an anxiety disorder. What's much more common is people come in with some kind of relationship trouble, whether it's at work or at home. And back in my first book, The Dance of Anger, I describe the anxiety-driven behaviors that keep people in this circular dance. And, you know, to simplify, for example, you have two anxious people, and they might not even know what they're anxious about, and they are just locked into distance and blame. So they may come in my office, it may be two partners, it may be a mother and daughter, and they cannot discuss anything besides sports and the weather, without immediately getting polarized. They will quickly divide into two opposing camps. When people are anxious, they very quickly divide into two camps and get over-focused on what the other party is doing wrong and under-focused on their own creative options to move differently. So again, whether it's two friends or a mother and daughter or two nations, that this is what you will see. Or in a family, you'll see an underfunctioning, overfunctioning polarity, where some people, when they're anxious, particularly firstborns, particularly if you're the older sister of a sister, where when stress hits, you may move in very quickly to have the answers, not only for yourself, but for everyone else. And when you're anxious, your style may be to move in very quickly to tell people what to do and to take over. So then you may be with a person, or there may be a family member, who underfunctions under stress, meaning that their way of managing stress is to get more flaky and not get up off the chair to help out and not problem solve and sort of appear to be the weak one or the basket case in the system. And the point about the dance and the different ways people manage anxiety, it's not that one way is right and one way is wrong, but if you put together a distancer and a pursuer, or an overfunctioner and an underfunctioner, each behavior provokes and maintains the behavior of the other. So the more you pursue a distancer, the more he distances, the more you pursue, or the more you overfunction. For an underfunctioner, the less able they will be to reach for their own competence, which of course invites you to think you have to move in and take over even more. And really what the work, what my books are about, what the work of therapy, what I think our work is about, and again, it's not that you have to root around in the past forever, but you do need to identify the ways in which you navigate relationships when you're anxious, whether it's distancing, pursuing, or mediating, or overfunctioning, or underfunctioning. And you do need to get self-focused enough to modify your own patterned anxious ways of moving. And that's hard to do. It's obviously hard to do in the political scene where the same thing happens. You get over-focused on the bad guys and under-focused and very creative problem-solving about how you can move differently to de-escalate things.
Yeah, what you said I think that's very important is that people in a state of anxiety always focus on what other people are doing. And then it just sort of pushes ahead. It sort of makes this wheel start turning, and it gets it spinning and spinning. It's the proverbial snowball picking up snow. And that one of the ways that people can stop themselves when they get spinning like that is to say, boy, I must be anxious because suddenly I'm just like dissatisfied with everything that's going on and I'm picking on everything. And maybe it has something to do with the way I'm feeling. That's almost a first step in knowing that something's wrong with you.
It's very much a first step. It's very much a first step to be able to think about what you do when you're anxious at every level. For example, at the individual level, when you're anxious, you may wake up 3 in the morning with your own personal anxiety-driven mantra, which may be something like, my ex is turning the kids against me, or my sister robbed me out of dad's money, or my mother is narcissistic. Now, it's not that you're wrong. It's that your brain is just ruminating about these things in a very non-productive way. And simply to be able to pay attention to the fact that that may be a real good barometer for you to know how much stress you're under. You know, some people, the more stress they're under, the more judgmental they get, or the more blaming they get.
Well, it's a controlling move. You're trying to control things outside of yourself because everything feels rather out of control when that's happening. But I think another thing that can happen is that you're just... I find that people, when they run simulations, are often running simulations that are very much the kind of negative messages that they picked up at home from their parents. You know, like trying to create a new way of working or trying to break out of some old habit, and you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a voice that says, this isn't going to work, because that's what you heard, you know, too much maybe as a child. You can't do that. You can't do what you want. You can't have what you want. You know, who do you think you are, kind of stuff. And that's very tricky because it's hard to unwind that feeling when it's happening. I mean, I actually had somebody suggest in a situation like that that you just take out a pad and a piece of paper and just start even writing with your left hand or drawing so that you connect with some part of you that's a little bit more innocent and so that you care for yourself in some way. Because sometimes you can't stop your brain when it's spinning like that. Even if you get it to stop looking at what everybody else is doing, still there can be just this feeling of everything is just not going to work.
Right. We're human. And when humans get anxious, the brain will, by the way, irrespective of your family of origin and those people who screwed you up, that when anxiety mounts, the brain will always push the extremes. And what I mean by pushing the extremes is if you look at an anxious person, they will either be caught in devaluing themselves. They'll lose perspective. They'll lose a sense of their own competence and worth and feel awful about themselves. Or the brain can do the opposite, where we all know people that when stress mounts, they get quite grandiose, and they, you know, the way they manage anxiety is to push the other extreme. And rather than feeling worthless and full of shame and totally inadequate, they feel superior. That is also an anxiety-driven response. And it actually took me a very long time to wrap my brain around a simple but very essential truth, which is that people who feel essentially superior to others are no different. It's no different than feeling essentially inferior. It's part of the same anxiety-driven, shame-driven loss of objectivity and perspective.
We need to take a brief break. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Okay. Finish your sentence, though.
I'll continue after the break.
Okay. When we come back from break, we're going to talk more about this issue of if you're feeling better than everybody else, you might not be actually feeling that way. This is Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Harriet Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, Ph.D. We're talking on Your Own Health and Fitness about fear. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us.
Go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever was there will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic. For every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play. Beneath the trees where nobody sees, they'll hide and seek as long as they please, 'cause that's the way the teddy bears have their picnic.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone today with Harriet Lerner, Ph.D., L-E-R-N-E-R, Ph.D. Her book is The Dance of Fear. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. If you miss parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, you can go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com, or you can call my information number at 707-874-2772. You can also go to Harriet Lerner's website, HarrietLerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, .com. And as we went to break, we were talking about how some people, I call this medicating behaviors. I mean, I think that when somebody starts to feel superior, what they're doing essentially is avoiding what they're really feeling.
Right. And to talk about, we've been talking about the effects of anxiety, some of the hidden, covert effects of this anxious soup we're all in. And anxiety does interfere with self-regard, or what we call self-esteem, which is the foundation on which all else rests. Because good self-esteem rests first and foremost on having an objective, balanced perspective on our strengths and weaknesses. We all have plenty of both. But anxiety, by its very nature, produces tunnel vision, and it will lead you to lose objectivity about the very complex, wonderful, flawed, ever-changing person that you are. And when you can't see yourself objectively, you won't see other people objectively either. So when you're anxious, it's not just that you went to the party and no one talked to you. It's that you went to the party and no one talked to you, and that means that you're not interesting and not attractive, and so it is, and so it will always be. Anxiety creates an atmosphere of terminal seriousness, self-flagellation, and self-blame, which isn't helpful, because the process of change and growth is essentially a self-loving task. And anxiety removes that lightness of being able to see our problems and our flaws with some humor. So as we were talking about, if you're under a lot of stress, it's quite common that people will either feel worthless and incompetent and like they cannot handle what life brings, or they will feel the opposite. They will feel essentially superior and better than other people and very judgmental. And unless those of you who are listening are a saint or a highly evolved Buddhist, you're going to partake in this in a fair amount of anxiety-driven judgmentalness, whether it's toward yourself or toward the other person it lands on. And as we were saying, the first step is to be able to, when you get in this judgmental, ruminative place, to see it as a good barometer of how anxious or stressed out you are.
I have a question. It's going to take me a minute to formulate it, but you use the example of you go to the party and nobody talks to you and you feel you go home and you have to, you know, you have to come to a conclusion and you go to the, you know, it's one of these, this means that, well, if nobody talked to me at the party, I must be a terrible person. But there's the other extreme, which is, you know, taking your clues from the outside world of the story you tell of somebody seeing a therapist who says some inappropriate, I would say inappropriate. My experience is that it would be inappropriate things to her.
Right.
And also even says to her that if she tries to go to another therapist, she will fail. And there's this terrible thing of, well, like, oh, this is somebody who's an expert and I'm supposed to rely on experts and I'm here because I'm having trouble tracking things. So there's that issue of how to find your way to understanding that things work differently for different people. So if I go to the party and nobody talks to me, it may be that that party wasn't a place that worked well for me and I may have been frowning, or some things work better than others, instead of I'm bad or I'm failing. But when it comes to taking your clues from the outside with an expert, choosing a therapist for someone who is having anxiety or fear or problems in navigating their own feelings, that's very toxic. And I'd like you to sort of speak to that issue of how you kind of stay in your skin and understand it's not a judgment of good or bad about everything that goes on. It doesn't even matter whether this therapist is good or bad in the end. What matters is what works for me.
Right. There's so many issues that you're raising here that are interesting. And one is about, as we get more mature, as we hopefully get more mature and get a grip on our anxiety, we can realize that rejection often has more to do with the other person, that we don't need to take rejection so personally. I mean, rejection is always the pits. It's not that anyone ever gets mature enough to totally not take it personally, but that's a direction to move in. And, you know, to have that balance in being able to look at one's own self.
Yeah, although if you're getting rejected constantly, it might be something that you're doing that may not be working. You know, in
exactly
other words, if you're for instance, I try to syndicate the show, and when you try to syndicate a radio show, you're talking to a lot of stations, and they have a thought that they have local programming that's the same as yours. So you may get rejected out of hand, as I said, not for the value of what you're doing, but it's very hard when you get rejected all the time. If that happens, which of course is not happening to me, but joking aside, but if it happens enough, you have to stop, look, you have to say, well, you know, maybe my approach is funny here, or maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree.
Or maybe you are putting yourselves in a situation, now I'm switching to the intimate relationship scene or friendship scene, that you may be staying for more than 5 minutes, which is too long, with somebody where the red flags are waving that this is not a person who will honor you and value you and treat you well. And in fact, you know, it's interesting, you were joking about, you know, what if you're rejected over and over and over, and is it you or is it them or everything? The Dance of Anger, my first book, which just had its 20th birthday, so happy birthday to The Dance of Anger. That book was rejected for 5 years.
Oh, God.
And it was, they weren't nice rejections, like, what an interesting manuscript, but it doesn't quite fit our list. They were rejections that were awful. Mm. And I revised that book, The Dance of Anger, for 5 years, as it was being rejected for 5 years, and I persisted. And I think we do our best to make decisions about, you know, this very complicated human dilemma of that we both need to look at ourselves as objectively as we can, and then sometimes we just have to really trust our own voice and say, no, you know, this is good, or this is what I need, even though everyone is saying, how can you do this, and you're so crazy. And going back to where you started, that is especially hard, to have a clear head when you're in an unequal power situation. Mm-hmm. If you're dealing with your doctor, especially if you're dealing with your therapist, I certainly see people, and I work more with women in this situation, I see people go into therapy and stay far too long mm-hmm. spinning their wheels because they become very loyal, and it's very difficult to evaluate clearly once you're in a therapy process, which is by nature an intense, somewhat anxious process. You forget that you have hired this person, and that you do, in any system, particularly with therapists or the medical system, you do need to protect yourself and be your own advocate and think as clearly as possible about whether you are getting the help that you came in for. And it's very hard for people, actually, to say, well, I think I'll try three different therapists.
It's terrible, most helpful, right?
And it's hard partly because of issues of expense and the reality, but it's also hard because people become very loyal and very muddled, not because we're muddled people. It's partly the nature of the therapeutic process.
It's very delicate, and people comfort themselves with habituated activity, and particularly if you choose a therapist who is perhaps very similar to, forgive me for always going back to this, to one of your parents, then you're going to be used to, or a relationship where there's and you can count on that there's going to be something in that relationship that reminds you, even just because humans are similar in certain ways, you're going to find something that's going to trigger something that's old for you, and you may be comfortable or habituated in that, as you put it, dance of, like you said, over-functioning or something, somebody's pursuing and somebody's over-functioning, somebody's pursuing, somebody's withdrawing. You may be comfortable in that, and you may not even think about the fact that you can do better or it can be better than that. I mean, we're talking a lot here about self-esteem and shame talking about this.
And you're also reminding us that change, there's no change without anxiety, even the
yes.
that we seek. So the devil you know is always easier than the devil you don't know.
When I'm beginning to understand that when I feel anxious, it's sometimes in a situation where I'm changing something, it's often, in a way, almost a good sign.
Right. Because
it means I'm pushing out my boundaries. I'm pushing out, you know, on the thing.
Right. If any listeners are thinking, well, I never feel anxious, well, then you're not trying hard enough.
Thank you. Oh, I love that. I also had a friend who, a very dear friend who always used to say, I never trust, this is a man too, never trust anyone who doesn't become hysterical.
Uh-huh.
Because
right.
it's just, you know, people, I always used to feel this way too. When I was dating, I remember if a man said that he was a happy guy, I used to think, uh-oh. No, I don't think so. Briefly again, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman on the phone with Harriet Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, PhD. The book we're talking about today is The Dance of Fear, although The Dance of Anger, as you pointed out, is in its a new pressing and has sold more than 2 million copies, its 20th anniversary edition. Congratulations on that. HarrietLerner.com to reach Harriet Lerner. Fear doesn't work alone, and as we said, there's self-esteem and there's shame. And it's interesting that shame seems to be a big deal for men.
I talk a lot about shame in The Dance of Fear, and just to define shame very loosely, we can think of it as the fear of being seen as essentially flawed or worthless or unworthy of love and respect. And shame is the emotion no one wants to to talk about. When I was writing The Dance of Fear, everyone wanted to tell me about their deepest fears, but nobody wanted to tell me about their deepest shame. Nobody wants to go there. And what happens with shame, this fear of being seen as essentially inferior or wrong, just sort of outside the flow of human connection, as Judy Jordan put it, very wonderful psychologist. And what people do with shame is two things that are not helpful to humans or to the world. Women do more of the first thing, men do more of the second. So to avoid shame, the first unhelpful thing people do is to keep their life very habitual, narrow, and small. So you don't get up and dance, you don't go to the party, you don't take the class, you don't put yourself out there. And you do then avoid the possibility of shame, but you keep your life narrow and small. You don't speak or act or be the way you might if you weren't so terrified about shame. So women do more of that. The other bad thing that
That's funny.
Do,
I know. I see men doing that as well.
Yes,
actually.
Yes. Men and women do both of these things. Absolutely. I believe from my own clinical work is, and my observations of the world, is men do a bit more of the second thing than women do. And the second thing is that some people can only sit with shame for a nanosecond. It's so painful. So they quickly flip shame into anger, domination, a need to be larger and bigger, a need to dominate and control. That shame very quickly can get flipped into aggression or a position of domination and control. And we need to do better than these two things. These two things of either sitting mute in a corner on the one hand or flipping shame into a need to dominate and control. I mean, we need to be able to face shame and not let it stop us from speaking and acting and being and doing, but to be our best selves. I mean, that really is what the challenge is about.
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book, The Dance of Fear, that's really helpful is about how you can get over this just by by doing it over and over again. Because if you're afraid of public speaking and you get up and as you did, you forget your note, your notes get taken off the podium and you're stuck there, or you drop things, or you fail a few times and you find a way to sort of be real in that situation. You try to just be honest. Oh gosh, well, this is not working quite the way I had hoped. And you're honest about what's going on, then people are grateful or something. You do it enough, or you go dancing and you look like an idiot, but you have a good time or something. You know, you
That's
do
right.
it enough so that you learn that, and you find out that some people will like you and some people won't like you, and the world goes on. You know, that there's a wonderful Zen koan that I think of when I have an anxiety attack, which is, it says, count the stars in the sky. And everybody has a different experience of this, but my experience of it is that when I count the stars in the sky, I think, what am I getting worked up about here, really? This is very small, you know, compared to, wow, look at that.
So, by the way, that's so important at every level, that one of the things anxiety does is it narrows your perspective. Anxious people lose sight of history and the future and a broad perspective of the universe. And when people can, I mean, it helps to be able to calm down, but whether it's the stars or being out in nature or being able to look at a person and see them in the context of generations and history, just rather than the context of one behavior, any way that you can look at the stars, meaning any way that you can broaden your perspective and back up that lens setting, that camera, to take in a bigger picture and see the interconnectedness of all things, you're going to be calmer and you're going to do better.
There are two things I wanted to get in before we run out of time that I think relate to health specifically. And one is when people become ill and they become dependent or they're suffering a lot because they're ill, or they're suffering because they're suffering, there's shame because they feel, as they compare themselves to other people, that they're different, and they feel a sense of shame, and that's very, very painful. The second that we can go back to, I'll just mention it now so you have a heads up, is the issue of fear and decision-making, both positive and negative aspects to, like, for instance, medical decisions. But let's take on first the issue of what happens to people when they're ill and they have to interact with other people and everybody's all acting out, really.
Yeah, I have a chapter in the Dance of Fear called When Things Fall Apart, which is about when the universe sends us the most difficult lessons in fear, anxiety, and shame, which happens with chronic illness or untimely death, which we're all vulnerable to. And in terms of shame, the challenge of illness is absolutely much greater in a culture like ours that does shame people for not having a positive attitude. We live in a culture where we are told that we should transform even the most unfathomable losses into a positive growth experience. And that even if we grieve, we should get over it in a prescribed amount of time. Now, obviously, it's not useful for any of us to drown in grief. And obviously, there's something positive about positive thinking. But very often this emphasis on positive thinking reflects other people's discomfort with the grief or the pain that you're feeling. And I don't think we leave much room for authentic expressions of grief and pain. I think it was bell hooks who said, you know, in our culture, the hip, you know, if you're hip, you're not supposed to get bogged down in grief. And, of course, everyone is supposed to be very healthy and able-bodied. So there is this dreadful layer of shame that is put on people who are just doing what we all do, which is that, as you pointed out earlier, we're all going to face every kind of loss, including physical losses, if not now, then later.
Well, also, if we're paying attention, some of that is happening all the time. I mean,
sure.
Women, as they age, experience grief. Moving to a new place, even if you were excited about doing it, there's grieving about your old life. I mean, there's an inevitable, as you can't reach for something without dropping something else. We only have two hands, right? So, or something
right.
like that.
Right.
So there's grieving is, it feels to me like an appropriate state that comes and goes in life.
Right, and what I'm saying is that when the universe sends us more than our fair share of suffering,
yeah.
Which happens to most people, if not sooner than later, but yeah. when that happens, I think there is a cultural emphasis that people should keep that hidden, basically, that
yeah.
that's not good and that they should, you know, again, you know, think positively, which is fine if it's balanced and in perspective, but it's not fine when other people simply don't want to see your pain. You can be left profoundly isolated to the extent that you're shamed for your honest suffering.
So a lesson here would be for caretakers of people to go ahead and be honest about your boundaries, taking the clues from the story in Dance of Fear, and be honest about what you're feeling with the person that you're helping, because if you're hiding that stuff, you're not helping them because they're picking up on how you feel either way.
And all of us have to think as intelligently as possible about, you know, in terms of showing real feelings, the notion that you always go around expressing your real self is very
no. Sometimes you should hold back. Yeah,
right?
Sometimes you should hold back. But
absolutely,
but I think that people
right.
still need to be honest about their limitations and what they're willing to show up for and stuff.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. You're talking about the ability, if you're a
caretaker
now, to be able to. Because when you're a caretaker, you can begin to absorb so much anxiety
mm-hmm.
that you're hanging on by your fingernails, and it can be tremendously courageous to be able to say, I can't do this. We need to, you know, bring in more help because there are limits to what I can do. And if you're an overfunctioner and a firstborn and you play the role of the American Red Cross, it can be terrifically hard to be able to say, I am exhausted, I'm depleted, I'm ready to crawl into bed with you, I can't do so much. Let me tell you what I can and can't do. It takes tremendous courage.
And I just want to mention, before we go on to fear and decision-making, one quick thing, which is that in both of your books, something you point out that people should be prepared for is that when you take a stand and you stand up for yourself, you should probably not expect the other people to just accept it nicely, because they're going to want you to continue to do what you've been doing. So you may get kind of a negative reaction. People may try to pull you back into your old behavior. But the reason you do it, and you should think about it before you do it, about whether that's going to be enough for you, is for yourself, not for them.
Exactly. And in The Dance of Anger, in my first book, I talk about counter moves, the fact that we know from all the research on human systems that when you make an important substantive change, it might be as seemingly little as saying to a partner, you know, I can no longer cook dinner every night. You know, I'm going to cook dinner twice a week, and otherwise it's not going to get made. You know, we'll all just sort of snack or whatever. That even a seemingly simple change, other people will not applaud you. They will not say, oh, how wonderful that you're being so assertive and taking such better care of yourself and being such an autonomous, independent person. Other people, especially the people who love you, your mother, your sister, your partner, will say, you're wrong, that's selfish.
How can
you say that? You're going to kill your mother, change back.
Right.
And now, the challenge, again, is to not get defensive or critical or distant, but to say, you know, this is how I feel, this is the ground I stand on, this is what I need to do for myself.
So we just have a minute, and I'm sorry to do that to you with so little time, but I think it would be really interesting for people to hear you talk about decision-making and fear.
Well,
it comes up a lot in medical decisions, and I think it's both positive and negative fear in those situations.
To make good decisions, you need to calm down first. And when you can't calm down, for example, if I go to the doctor and it's going to be difficult news, I will always bring a clear-thinking person with me. I will never try to be a do-it-yourselfer when it comes to anything regarding my health, because I tend to get, or the health of someone I love, I tend to get quite anxious, like with my kids. One of the most important things to remember about anxiety is to strike when the iron is cold.
Oh, that's good advice.
And I mean that in two ways. One is you don't have to confront your mother or your sister or your boss in the heat of intensity. Any confrontation you make when you're feeling very intense may be non-productive. So strike when the iron is cold.
That's wonderful.
And in terms of medical decisions, you have to calm down first and to think clearly. No one thinks clearly in the midst of a tornado.
Yes.
And when you can't think clearly, I mean, I tend, when I'm calm, to think of myself as a very highly mature, evolved Zen Buddhist person. But when I'm anxious, I have the brain of a reptile. So in those situations, as I said, I will find a clear-headed
person
to
help
me.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry to give you that with so few little time. Thank you so much for your work and for helping us during this hour to understand your work. Harriet Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R, Ph.D., her books, The Dance of Fear and The Dance of Anger, we've been discussing today, her website, harrietlerner.com. Dr. Lerner, thank you again so much.
My pleasure.
I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you want a cassette copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about guests, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.com. Also information there on subscribing to the newsletter Progressive Health Observer. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5x11 Productions, and KPFA-FM. The engineer today for Your Own Health and Fitness is Dev Ross. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.